Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Roxy Todd, in for Jessica Lilly, who will be back next week. When coal companies declare bankruptcy, sometimes it's the workers who are left in the lurch without pay. That's what happened for miners who work for Black Jewel. Curtis Kress says the uncertainty of not having a paycheck is making him consider leaving the coal industry for good.
You never know from one day to the next if you're going to have a job. They'll get you used to making a whole lot of money and then kind of take it away.
So in protest, some of these miners have been blocking a train track for more than 2 months. They say they're not leaving until they get paid. Is the situation at Black Jewel Mine a foreshadowing of more turmoil in the future?
What happens when the industry is shrinking so rapidly that we see mines simply abandoned?
Also in this episode, we'll hear from a woman who found recovery and a job after struggling with drug addiction for more than 2 decades.
You don't have to wake up sick every day. That pill you think you can't do without, you can. There is hope. There is hope.
We'll hear that story and more this week inside Appalachia.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, bringing food from your local neighborhood farmer to you at West Virginia Farmers Markets. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Roxy Todd. Today, we'll look at how our history is intertwined with our future. We'll hear from coal miners and children about how they are reshaping Appalachia while remembering the past. We start in Harlan County, Kentucky. Last week was Labor Day, which honors the American labor movement. Here in Appalachia, that history brings back some fierce memories for some, particularly those in Harlan County, Kentucky. In the 1930s, union miners demanded better pay and working conditions. They fought against coal company owners and police officers. During the conflict, several people were killed on both sides. Now, almost 100 years later, another group of miners is protesting their employer, Black Jewel Coal. They've been there, camped out, blocking a railroad for more than 2 months. The miners haven't been paid since Black Jewel filed for bankruptcy in the middle of July. So the workers are preventing a coal train from leaving the coal mine, demanding that they receive their paychecks they say the company owes them. Reporter Sydney Bowles has been following the protests since day one. After the miners had been there a month, she produced a piece exploring what the protest says today about the state of organized labor in the mines. We're going to start with that story. Here's WMMT reporter Sydney Bowles in Cumberland, Kentucky.
Black Jewel's bankruptcy left more than 1,000 Appalachian miners without pay and no way to know if they still had jobs, health insurance, or their retirement savings. On July 29th, 5 miners saw an opportunity. A train full of coal was leaving a Harlan County loading facility. The 5 men clambered onto the railroad tracks to block the train, and they didn't leave for over a week.
No pay, no coal! No pay, no coal!
If they can load a train out, they can give us our money.
We're suffering, our kids are suffering, our families are suffering. As long as I gotta stay here, I'll stay.
The railroad protest has been entirely nonviolent. But for many, the Black Jewel bankruptcy and the resulting protest recalled an earlier period in Harlan County's history.
This thing here, it's put you in the mind of Bloody Harlan back years ago.
Bloody Harlan. The name comes from the violent struggle between coal companies and workers hoping to organize, first in the 1930s and then again in the early 1970s.
Last year, the coal mining camps became Bloody Harlan all over again. As the strike dragged on for more than a year, 2 miners were shot, 1 man was killed.
You have to look at Bloody Harlan in a long history of a bloody coal industry.
That's labor historian Rosemary Feurer of Northern Illinois University. She says the coal industry pushes the full cost of coal onto workers' health, workers' wages, and the environment. Feurer says the United Mine Workers of America arose from the workers' demands for better treatment.
What the miners were saying is we can't be basically just extraction engines and tools left to die of black lung.
The union successfully negotiated better wages and benefits for miners and won health and safety standards that are still in place today. But union membership is in decline across the country, and the miners' union has declined faster than most. Between 1997 and 2017, overall mine employment in the Ohio Valley dropped by 50%. In the same period, UMWA membership dropped by 76%.
The reason that unions have really been imperiled in the southern parts of the country is because they've been told that the only way that the South can rise again is by being a non-union, anti-union reserve.
By 2017, there were no union miners left working in Bloody Harlan, and only a handful in all of Kentucky. Many Black Jewel miners had never worked for a union mine in their careers. Phil Smith is a spokesperson for the UMWA. He worries that a weak union puts miners at risk of losing protections that previous generations fought for.
The minute that a government who is intent on doing away with many of these worker protections feels like they can without there being any political blowback from that, for doing that, they're going to do it.
Smith finds hope in teacher strikes across the country and efforts to unionize other workplaces.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a resurgence in people interested in making sure that they have a voice at work.
Chris Lewis was among the first miners to block the train. His views on unions are complicated.
I was raised union, and I believe in the union, but I also believe in a man's right to provide for his family, you know what I'm saying?
Lewis believes that if Black Jewel had a union, his family wouldn't be in this predicament. Now, Lewis has a new job in a coal mine in Alabama. In that new job, he will be part of a union. Curtis Kress is sitting in the gravel beside a Harlan County, Kentucky railroad track. Tall and thin, with a long black beard, Kress is a coal miner. Or he was, until a month ago.
It was part of my, I guess, heritage, you know, my dad and papaws and all that had always done it. And I'm proud, you know, of that heritage.
Kress has been at these railroad tracks for days with little sleep. He's here to protest his former employer, Black Jewel Coal. Black Jewel's chaotic bankruptcy left about 1,000 miners like Kress with bounced paychecks and unpaid bills, and largely in the dark about their future. That lack of clarity seems mirrored in the coal industry itself. Black Jewel's bankruptcy is just one of a slew of bankruptcies to rock the coal industry recently. Kentucky Coal Association spokesperson Tyler White notes that Black Jewel Coal isn't part of the KCA. Still, he says, Black Jewel employees shouldn't have been treated that way.
There are also current companies that are going through bankruptcy that have not had these disruptions. This is related to one company and one company's actions. With that being said, overall, what this looks like for the coal industry is, and what it shows for is that, you know, the coal industry is still struggling with a lot of overburdensome regulations that were put on us in a previous administration.
Regulation is just part of the story. Market trends are important too. For the first time in modern history, this year, the U.S. produced more energy from renewable sources than from coal, and the availability of cheap natural gas has led to a steep decline in employment in the mining sector. In 1997, there were about 19,000 coal jobs in Kentucky. In 2017, there were about 6,000.
We're sort of in the early stages of the end game, I would say, of sort of the coal economy.
That's Clark Williams-Derry, the director of energy finance for Sightline Institute, a research organization based in Seattle. He says we can expect more chaotic bankruptcies like Black Jewel's.
We're in uncharted territory. We don't really know what happens in sort of, you know, in the modern world of coal, what happens when the industry is shrinking so rapidly that we see mines simply abandoned.
In days spent sitting on the train tracks, Black Jewel miners have plenty of time to consider what that means for them. Miner Caleb Levins says he's too far into the business to hope for anything else.
This ain't a game. We're not a bunch of kids. We're grown men with families around here in the Appalachian Mountains. This is all we got, you know, just the coal mines. And we've been too far into the coal mines to try to turn around and go to college for 12 years. We got 12-year-old kids, you know, they need us now. They don't need us in 10 years.
But Curtis Kress says he's done with the industry. He wants out.
You never know from one day to the next if you're going to have a job. They'll get you used to making a whole lot of money and then kind of take it away.
A father of four, Kress is at risk of losing his home. He says he feels hopeless about what comes next, but he thinks his best bet is to find work in manufacturing. He hopes his kids leave the region when they're old enough. Black Jewel's Harlan County mines have been sold to a new company, Copper Glow. Miners will at least get some of the money they're owed, and some of them, soon, will go back to work underground. But for many of these miners and their industry, what's coming down the tracks is anything but certain. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Sydney Bowles in Cumberland, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the Black Jewel miners are still there, more than 2 months since they began their protest in eastern Kentucky. They still say they're not going home until their employer gives them their paychecks. In a minute, we'll hear about several programs that offer people in recovery a chance to work by growing and making food. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Roxy Todd. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu. Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping farmers share their food with your family every week at your local farmers market. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
We've heard the grim statistics about how our region suffers from some of the nation's highest rates of addiction and overdose deaths. We're going to spend the next part of our show looking at several programs that are trying to change that. Across Appalachia, some people in recovery from drug addiction are finding employment and support on farms and in restaurants. Brittany Patterson has the story.
Twinkle lights and fresh flowers greet diners when they walk into Cafe Appalachia, a former church-turned-farm-to-table restaurant located in South Charleston, West Virginia. Today's menu includes pork tips, zoodles, roasted broccoli, and a salad from spinach grown a few miles away. Autumn McCraw works at the cafe.
I start my tasks as the barista here, making coffee, make sure the tea's prepared.
But this cafe is more than just a job. It's a second chance. McCraw heard about Cafe Appalachia while participating in long-term recovery treatment.
If I'm struggling, if it happens to be one of those days, you know, I have a whole support system here that understands.
Almost everyone who works at Cafe Appalachia is in recovery. It's part of a new grant-funded program that aims to use agriculture to create jobs for those in recovery and coming out of prison.
Welcome to Paradise Farms.
The cafe gets much of its food from this hydroponic farm just outside of Charleston. Participants begin the program here, learning how to farm both in the classroom and in the greenhouses. Later, they can work at the cafe, or soon a food truck and catering service. Reggie Jones is the head of one of the nonprofit partners of the project.
So not only are we really working to increase healthy food access, we're also finding jobs for individuals who are coming out of recovery.
And Jones isn't the only one that sees that opportunity in the Ohio Valley. Deviate Kitchen started serving breakfast and lunch fare in Lexington, Kentucky, more than a year and a half ago. Like Cafe Appalachia, almost all employees are recovering from addiction.
When we're trying to make the best bread, the best sandwich, the best salad that we possibly can make, it is so therapeutic to serve someone.
That's Rob Perez. He and his wife, Diane, started Deviate Kitchen after having several former employees die from addiction.
There was 12 people that have passed away that we had employed, and now it's 15 people, so just losing people was a big lever.
They believe in the bonding power of making and serving food, but the restaurant does more. Employees are required to be in sober living housing, and they close in the afternoon to let employees attend counseling appointments. And locals, including therapists, yoga instructors, police officers, and more, come in every Tuesday to lead the employees in talks and activities. It's something Diane says has been a game changer.
That's, I think, been super important to let them know that it's not just us giving them a job, it's the whole community rallying around them.
But it took time for the community to be there. Diane and Rob struggled for months to attract customers because of the stigma that recoveries would mean bad service.
And when they heard Second Chance Restaurant, they thought second rate.
Clinical experts say that stigma is a common challenge for businesses who hire those recovering from addiction. Zendaya Lawson of the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services says while employment can be extremely positive for someone in recovery, the initiatives still need to be sustainable.
The business rules still apply that there has to be a need and a demand for the service or the product that is being provided.
And that's why people leading these grassroots efforts believe in food and agriculture, because of what they see as its potential for sustainability.
Food is fundamental.
Janine Harrison founded Grow Huntington, an organization that runs an urban farm managed by those in recovery in Huntington, West Virginia. Grow Huntington got its start through crowdfunding in 2016 and now partners with the local university to sell compost. She says many regional food and agriculture efforts are often grant-funded, and grant funding doesn't last forever. But Harrison believes it's worth it, despite past financial instability with grants.
Fresh, local food and, you know, work for people who may not be able to find it as easily. Absolutely. That is a powerful, powerful way to create change.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Brittany Patterson.
Next, we're going to hear about a bakery and a community center in eastern Kentucky in a town called Neon. Black Sheep Brick Oven Bakery hires people who are in recovery and are going through the local drug court program. Drug court, if you're not familiar, is an alternative to jail for people who suffer from drug addiction who commit nonviolent crimes. Instead of going to prison, they go through an intensive recovery program. They have to take regular drug tests, attend Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and do community service. Usually, one of the final steps of drug court is finding a job. But if you've struggled with addiction, not many employers are willing to take a chance on hiring you. So Black Sheep decided to make it their mission to hire people in recovery. WMMT's Rachel Geringer sat down with the manager of the bakery to talk about why they shifted their hiring policy.
We're in Hempel Community Center right now. I'm Gwen Johnson. I am a volunteer and a board member here. I work with all the community center stuff, but most especially Black Sheep Brick Oven Bakery.
And what is the bakery?
The bakery is a social enterprise that when the coal industry took a hit and was virtually going down the tubes, we were trying to find a funding stream for our community efforts, and so we decided on a bakery project. We had always cooked and catered, and so we thought a more solid business presence might be the way to do it, and so we just have established a bakery. We were looking at latent assets in our community, trying to figure out what to do in the time of despair that we were in, with not thinking that we were going to be able to survive the change. And so one of the things that we had been doing was we have been using some of the drug court participants when we were not using them per se, that's probably the wrong way to put it. We were letting them use us to get their community service requirement. And so we began to realize that they were great workers and they were creative, and if given a task, they would perform it above and beyond the call of duty. And so we thought that this might be a good way to let them work for money, because we were going to have to hire somebody. And with the opioid crisis that's been in our area, we've tried to hire some people off the streets in the past, and we found pill bottles and pill crushers and that sort of thing. There's such a problem here. And so the folks in drug court are in such a regimented program with mandatory drug testing and that sort of thing that they were perfect employees, because their feet are already being held to the fire. Plus, they can't hardly get a job in the community. And so we were needing somebody and they were needing somebody, and it's just been the perfect marriage and effort for all of us. And we've created a little free space here that we call the hate-free zone. And so we're just having a really good time, and we're creating a place for marginalized people to have a place to belong if they choose to come and hang out with us. And so it's really working out well for everybody concerned.
That was Gwen Johnson, a volunteer and a manager at Black Sheep Bakery in Kentucky, speaking with Rachel Geringer. Rachel also talked with three of the employees at the bakery, all of whom are in the Letcher County Drug Court Program. We don't have time for their entire conversation in today's show, but I do want to play this clip. This is Evelyn Adkins, who has this advice for anyone who is struggling with substance use disorder and wants help.
I would start going to meetings. And I would reach out to somebody that didn't use. And I would stay away from those that did. There is hope. There is hope. There's a better way. You don't have to wake up sick every day. That pill you think you can't do without, you can. You can do without it. I mean, and there is hope. Just reach out. The people that you think won't help you will be the ones that will. The ones you think that are out to get you are the ones that really care about you. I just like to see everybody get better.
Yeah.
That's my wish.
We've posted a longer version of that interview on our website, in which Evelyn tells her story about struggling with drug addiction for 2 decades and finding recovery. It's at wvpublic.org. The successes of drug court programs have led lawmakers in some states to launch family treatment courts. West Virginia is piloting one of these programs this week. Here's how it works. A majority of cases that include abuse and neglect involve a parent who's addicted to drugs. These parents may lose their parental rights, and their children go to live in a foster home or with a relative. This is one reason West Virginia's foster care system is in crisis. According to the State Department of Health and Human Resources, 7,000 children are now in the state's care. Judges try to help parents who are addicted get into drug treatment so they can get their kids back, but it's tough. And in West Virginia, only about half of these parents are eventually reunited with their children. But now, with this new program, families in family treatment court will go through an even more intensive recovery process, meet more regularly with a judge, and parents get coaching on how to make changes in their life. The goal is to increase the number of families that get to stay together. Reporter Emily Allen spent the day in Boone County, one of 3 counties that's piloting this new approach. She has this story.
The Boone County Circuit Court is overwhelmed with child abuse and neglect cases. The opioid epidemic has exacerbated the number of parents separated from their children. It's also led to a surge in parents who never reunify with their kids, and that in turn leads to more kids in the foster care system. The existing process for abuse and neglect cases does provide opportunities for parents to get clean, turn their lives around, and get their kids back. Circuit Court Judge Will Thompson says that kind of reunification has always been the end goal.
We want to be able to put these children back with their families in a safe and loving environment.
But that kind of family reunification is rare. You can blame it on the fact that there's too many families and not enough attorneys or caseworkers. You can blame it on the high levels of poverty and fewer job opportunities in the area. Or you can simply just blame it on the opioid crisis. Judge Thompson doesn't have the magic answer to all of the problems in his community. But starting next week, His court and two others in the state are trying something new.
A week from now, we will start taking referrals for family treatment court, and that's a court where we're going to apply the lessons we've learned in our drug courts to actually the abuse and neglect model.
Family treatment court and drug court are two types of what's called problem-solving courts that exist nationwide. West Virginia has had drug courts for a number of years. Judge Thompson actually already runs a few drug courts for adults and juveniles in Boone County.
We're going to try to attempt some behavior modification with the use of positive responses to behavior when they do something good, negative responses to behavior when they do something bad.
In drug court, participants can avoid jail time by following a sort of improvement plan to turn their lives around. What the judge orders depends strongly on the participant. Some people will have to go to treatment. Others will have to find a job, go back to college, get their license. In family treatment court, the process will be more involved. In the existing abuse and neglect system, the judge checks in on families trying to get their kids back every 6 to 8 weeks. In family treatment court, the judge will check in on parents more regularly.
Family treatment court is going to involve a weekly meeting where we're going, the court, that being me, as well as the treatment team, is going to know on a weekly basis how that family is doing and how that will help. Do we need, if the family's not doing well, what do we need to do to fix that? Do we need to increase the services? Do we need to have more involvement with that family? Or if the family is doing well, what can we do to further this case along?
In family treatment court, parents will have access to more resources for treatment, and there will be personnel specifically available to provide them with help, like counselors. And parents will get to see their kids more regularly. Right now, some parents have to go through a few drug screenings before even having a supervised visit with their child.
We have decided from the beginning that we're not going to use visits as a behavioral response, where it's not going to be a sanction or a reward, because we're not sanctioning and rewarding children for their parents' conduct.
As long as it's safe for the child, Judge Thompson says he's hoping parents can see their kids once to twice a week when they start family treatment court. Later in the process, those visits might become unsupervised or overnights, as long as the parents are getting better.
And the hope there is not only does that help with the children, it will also hopefully motivate their parents to want to get the help quicker and want to get the help in a more effective way.
Thompson says it'll be some extra work at first, but ultimately, family treatment court might keep some kids out of an overwhelmed foster care system that's expensive to the state and damaging to its kids. L. Scott Briscoe is what's called the guardian ad litem in Boone County. He's appointed by Judge Thompson to represent the kids in these abuse and neglect cases. Combined with the number of juveniles Briscoe also represents, he's dealing with roughly 300 kids at a time.
22 years ago, when I started doing abuse and neglect cases, we would do maybe 5 in a week. Jump forward to today, 22 years later, and we've done as many as 50 hearings on just a Monday.
Mondays are reserved in Boone County for family abuse and neglect cases. I recently sat in the courtroom for one of these Mondays. There were preliminary hearings, check-ins, dismissals. Some parents relinquished custody, and there was even one adoption. Roughly half of the hearings were what the judge refers to as empty chairs. That's when a parent doesn't show up to court.
We're drowning in child abuse neglect cases. We're drowning in it. It's more than CPS can handle. It's more than the prosecutor can handle. And the judge, it was never a part of the docket like it is now.
At the end of the day, a lot of kids end up wards of the state. Briscoe says he rarely gets to see parents take their kids back. And only a few kids get adopted.
But those are the happy endings that I get to see that gives me hope that there are still people out there that care about these children, that want to take care of these children.
Family treatment court likely won't do anything about parents who aren't motivated to get their kids back. But both Thompson and Briscoe say it's not about the statistics or the number of families that will be saved. It's about helping as many kids as they can.
At this point, I'm willing to try anything and everything, just like Judge Thompson, because right now, we have so many kids whose parents, their rights have been terminated or relinquished. And we have overwhelming numbers of children being adopted by their grandparents because their parents are either dead or in prison. So I hope that with a better focus and more time spent with these families with a better quality system and attention to their needs that will improve the rate of success with reunification with the family.
Judge Thompson says Boone County is holding an event on October 7th at the courthouse in Madison to update local media on the progress Family Treatment Court will have made. He says he hopes to have 10 to 12 families in the program at that point. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Emily Allen in Boone County, West Virginia.
Emily is a Report for America Corps member. A large part of her focus is to report on the changing economy in southern West Virginia. We're going to stick with Emily for our next few stories. If you've been following the community of Montgomery in Fayette County, you'll know they've been hit hard these last few years. First, they suffered economically when coal mines in the area began laying off workers. Then a second blow befell Montgomery when the West Virginia legislature decided to move the local college, WVU Tech, from Montgomery to Beckley. People expressed outrage over the move, and now it's uncertain what will happen to the mostly deserted campus. But here's an interesting twist. The West Virginia National Guard is planning a new military-style academy in Montgomery. It takes teenagers who are at risk of not graduating through a strict 22-week program, which includes high school academics and physical education. There's already one of these facilities in Preston County that's been around since the 1990s. Emily Allen explains more about the National Guard's first Challenge Academy.
The original Mountaineer Challenge Academy at Camp Dawson in Preston County operates out of a long hallway. There's four computer labs, four traditional classrooms, a cafeteria, a small library, and a gym. When I visited the academy in July, the students, or cadets, were in their third week of the program. At the time, the academy was working with a class of about 180 cadets, half of which were gathered in the gym to collect their uniforms for the rest of the school year. 180 is well over the program's target class size of 150 cadets. To make matters more complicated, Major General James Hoyer with the West Virginia National Guard says the existing campus can't grow anymore.
Right now, for Challenge Academy, we'll turn away in any given class a wait list anywhere from 25 to 50 kids.
That's why Hoyer and several others say it's time for the academy to add a second location that might be more accessible for Southern families and others in the state's farthest corners.
You know, Camp Dawson's a great place, but it is remote and it is hard for families to get kids to Camp Dawson.
The academy has graduated students from all 55 of the state's counties. When the school opened in 1993, it was one of the first Youth Challenge Academies in the nation. The military-style program puts academically at-risk teenagers on a strict routine with high school classes and regular physical activity. Today, there's almost 40 of these programs nationwide. Advocates for the academy say this routine translates to success for these young people. According to the school, 55% of last year's graduating class went on to employment. 16% joined the military, 12 went on to college, and 17 went on to vocational training. With another location, Academy Director Bob Morris says the academy could do even more for the state and its youth.
What's West Virginia need right now? We need a workforce that can get up for work, perform their job, and is drug-free. And that's what we can offer.
The academy already has made some changes to help Southern cadets and their families.
We're trying a couple of different things. First, as far as transportation, last class for Memorial Day, we transported kids home for leave, and we also brought them back from leave.
The school has also begun offering a few of its mandatory orientation days off campus in southern locations. This year, it hired a recruiter to focus solely on Southern County teens. When I was at Camp Dawson, I got to speak with a few cadets from the southern counties. Most of them found out about the program through a graduate in their community, like Logan Helmendaller, who hails from Wyoming County.
I learned about Mountaineer Challenge Academy through a couple past cadets, friends that I had that weren't exactly going down the wrong path, but just really wanted to get back on to the right path with their schoolwork.
Getting to Preston County wasn't easy for Helmendaller. It took him more than 4.5 hours to get to Camp Dawson. But he says he likes the distance. If the academy were closer, he might have left sooner.
Being away from home, the distance, it really helps me kind of mature in a sense.
Overall, adding a second location anywhere in the state could reduce the program's growing wait list. The bill mentioning a new academy doesn't specify where in Fayette County the school has to go. Neither has the legislature provided any official timeline for when the school must open. Hoyer says the National Guard has its eyes on the former WVU Tech campus in Montgomery. He estimates the first year could cost $22 million for infrastructure and operating costs. And
obviously would give a shot in the arm to that Fayette County, Upper Kanawha County area that has faced some significant challenges since Tech had to move, and we think the potential exists to do something there.
Regardless of where and when the school opens, Morris says both programs will run the same.
What we have at Camp Dawson works, and we're going to take that same approach to the second location, the southern location. We know the structure works. We know our education works. And we're not going to reinvent the wheel.
It remains unclear when the state or the National Guard will share more details about a Mountaineer Challenge Academy in Montgomery.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Emily Allen at Camp Dawson in West Virginia. So the National Guard may open another new Youth Challenge Academy in Montgomery. As I mentioned earlier, this small town has been hit hard in recent years, first by layoffs in nearby coal mines, and next by the relocation of WVU Tech. So when the National Guard announced they may put a second Challenge Academy in Montgomery, it seemed possible the town could get a boost. But residents say they've heard very little about hosting the program. Again, Emily Allen has the story.
What was once Vinning Library in Montgomery is nearly empty.
This was the library?
This was the library.
Facility staff have given away most of the 300,000-plus books that it once held. The shelves are gone, and some of the carpet has been removed.
This was the study hall portion of the library. Most books.
That's Montgomery Mayor Greg Ingram, who graduated from WVU Tech in 1999. Ingram has been mayor for 4 years. Before that, he worked in the office as a city recorder. He's been around since the legislature voted in 2016 to move WVU Tech. And he's been around for all of the ideas since then about ways to fill the campus. Moving a second Mountaineer Challenge Academy to Montgomery is just the latest big idea that he's heard. Ingram says that after other failed ideas, he's skeptical the Academy will ever arrive.
The Challenge Academy would be a wonderful addition to Montgomery. We would welcome the Challenge Academy here, but I'll believe it when it happens.
State Senator Stephen Baldwin, a Democrat whose district includes Montgomery, says the idea isn't anything new. But when the legislature agreed to advocate for a new location in Fayette County last month, Baldwin says there was little discussion beforehand.
Frankly, the legislature had very few conversations about this. You know, they packaged this into the very last omnibus bill at the last minute, and it wasn't even ever discussed.
Senate President Mitch Carmichael, a Republican, says there was some discussion about the new academy during the regular session when legislators considered an earlier version of the omnibus bill. Legislators didn't add in the academy item until the bill came up again in special session. Baldwin voted against the most recent act due to its provisions relating to charter schools. But he says he still supports opening a new academy in Fayette County.
It's going to be an important employer in the area. It's going to provide a service that nobody else in southern West Virginia provides.
During my time in Montgomery, Mayor Ingram and I looked around some of the available buildings that WVU staff still maintain. 9 buildings from the campus remain unoccupied. Those include a recently renovated dining hall, fairly new and furnished dormitories, a ballroom, and a biology building.
All these buildings are beautiful buildings, and for whatever reason, a very sad and very bad public policy decision was made to move Tech to Beckley.
It's important to note that the old college had a long-standing history in Montgomery. dating back to the 19th century.
West Virginia Tech was created here in Montgomery in 1895. It was a school here and a college here, four-year college, for 125 years. It was born and raised by the residents in Montgomery.
When WVU Tech left, Ingram says Montgomery and the surrounding region lost millions of dollars in economic activity. Rob Alsop is the vice president of strategic initiatives for WVU, which still owns the campus. He says the university is dedicated to finding these buildings their best purpose.
We've had conversations with the city and county leaders, as well as state officials, about potential uses of the campus. And so we've really been trying to brainstorm on what's the best use of those facilities.
WVU leadership recently approved the sale of the former business building to a developer looking to build low-income housing for seniors. The developer still hasn't closed the purchase yet. The university also transferred a few buildings to Bridge Valley and the city. It's renting the gym to the local YMCA. Shortly after the tech school was moved to Beckley, WVU tried to bring in KVC, a school for young adults who have aged out of the foster care system. That effort didn't pan out, leading some Montgomery residents to wonder if the Mountaineer Challenge Academy will be any different. Alsop says there's little reason for skepticism this time due to how much more established the Mountaineer Challenge Academy is.
So unlike KVC, which was really plowing new ground and trying to do something brand new and innovative, the Challenge Academy is very innovative, but I think if you were to talk to General Hoyer or the National Guard, you know, they've got a ready established playbook for the Challenge Academy, and they know what they're doing. They know how to change kids' lives.
As talks on bringing another program to the former WVU Tech campus continue, the state's financial commitment remains in question. The West Virginia National Guard estimates the first year will cost about $22 million. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Emily Allen in Montgomery, West Virginia.
Coming up next, during this past summer, some kids spent a week learning to make stop-action animated films. Others learned an old-fashioned type of storytelling using something known as a cranky. What's that? We'll explain in just a sec. But first, I want to announce the winner of a contest we've been doing. We asked you, our listeners, to send us the questions you'd like us to investigate. Then, listeners voted on their favorite. The story we will be exploring here on Inside Appalachia is, could West Virginia be self-sustaining? It won more than 40% of the vote. So, say the rest of the world fell off the map. What would we do? Could we feed ourselves, support ourselves? What would happen? Sort of a thought experiment. If you have a tip for us or know who might be a good source for this story, please send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or send us a tweet. We're at InAppalachia. My Twitter handle is Roxy M. Todd. Jessica Lilly is Jessica Y. Lilly. We'll play the story in a couple of months. Thanks to everyone who sent us your ideas and voted. Well, school is back in session, and many kids are probably thinking fondly of the best parts of summer. When I was a kid, I desperately wished that summer camp could have gone on throughout the school year. I always loved swimming, making s'mores, telling ghost stories, you name it. It was definitely more fun than taking tests indoors back at school. But I think I would have really loved the type of camp that 9 students in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, attended this past summer. They spent a week learning to make short animated films at Monster Movie Camp. I was there, too, to help teach audio techniques to the kids, and I recorded this story. My good friend Brooke Schumann was the one organizing the camp. I'll admit, until I saw the kids at work at their movies, I didn't really understand what Monster Movie Camp was. It's day 5. The kids are all standing at their workstations, hurriedly putting the final touches on the illustrations for their film. Molly Cook is drawing the shape of a funny-looking monster with a magic marker.
I just like drawing. I'm only 10. I'm the youngest person in this class.
Molly is working on a short animated film about a legendary cryptid from Braxton County known as the Flatwoods Monster. After drawing the images, or creating a set with sculpture, the students use iPads to film their movies. They've spent days working on their small sets and filming their stop-action animation. Many of the students say they signed up partly because they like to draw. Jesse Kelly says he likes theater and performing and wanted to learn to make movies as another creative outlet.
I think I surprised myself on like a couple of things that I did because I didn't think I could do it that good. Like once I watched it, I was like, oh, that's better than I thought it would be.
The Pocahontas County Opera House hosted the 5-day monster movie camp. Artist Brian Richards and writer Howard Parsons also helped teach the students how to animate stories. On the final day of camp, the students showed their parents their films, which were projected on a big screen inside the Pocahontas Opera House. We've posted some of the students' work from Monster Camp, including a short film about the Mothman monster dancing, on our website at wvpublic.org. Check it out. Another week-long art camp, which was part of a series of camps in Morgantown this past summer, introduced elementary-age students to a special storytelling art form, rooted in Appalachian tradition. Our Folklife reporter, Caitlin Tan, brings us the story. That's the sound of 16 students building crankies. Crankies are these long illustrated scrolls wound around two spools within a wooden box, usually with a song or poem. Sometimes crankies are called a moving panorama. Timmy Carlson is 11 years old and is painting a cranky box bright orange.
It has paper wrapped around two scrolls, and when you turn the cranks, it moves forward, and you can draw either different frames or you can draw just one big picture that you scroll to see. And it kind of moves, and it's like an old form of entertainment before TVs.
The cranky is thought to have originated in the United Kingdom in the 1800s. It made its way to Appalachia to tell stories and accompany music. World-renowned storyteller Peter Stevenson is something of a cranky expert. He lives in Wales, but was in West Virginia this spring for an art exhibit, which featured some of his handmade crankies. Peter is especially interested in the historical connection of crankies to Appalachia.
They would sing a song, an old mountain ballad, play music, tell a story while the picture is moving. If you think about it, it's early animated film. Special effects movies, but without the electricity. So it's what they did up in the mountains before they had electric. They used these crankies.
Local artist Eddie Spaghetti also specializes in making crankies. His work was a part of the exhibit as well, and he's teaching the cranky class. He says they're kind of like old-timey YouTube videos.
So in a way, this cranky idea connects to something we're very comfortable with and familiar with in our modern age, but bringing back an old thing.
One of his students drew a story about Ned Flanders from The Simpsons. Eddie helps interpret the story with a song and ukulele.
Once upon a time there was a man named Ned. Got out his frisbee and got hit in the head.
Each student illustrates their song on a 10-foot-long paper. They write the song lyrics on it and draw and paint images that represent the song for them. Carlo Arthurs chose Don't Stop Me Now by Queen.
Around the mid, it's Don't Stop Me Now, so there's the finger wag. And then there's a stop sign, and then me. It's like, Don't Stop Me Now.
Once the scrolls are finished, they have to be installed on the wooden spools in a box.
They've been sawing, and they've been clipping, and they've been cutting, and they've been painting. You ready? Just pull the trigger. Right, we rock it. It helps grab the wood a little bit. That's it. Okay.
Eddie helps the kids use a drill to create holes in the box for the spools, so the scroll can be turned.
Yeah, it's nice they get to do a little carpentry work as well.
On the last day of the camp, the kids present their crankies. The room is filled with wooden boxes that are a little bigger than a piece of printer paper. They're painted in every color. Zoe Gilliam chose the song Something Just Like This by the Chainsmokers and Coldplay. You can hear the distinct sound of turning wood while she sings.
But she said, where'd you wanna go? How much you wanna risk? I'm not looking for somebody with some superhuman gifts.
Carlo, the one who chose the Queen song, says learning to make a cranky has revealed his artistic side.
I'm better than I thought I was at art, at least, and I feel like art is something that I will do more often and try to do more often.
As he turns the wooden spool of his cranky, the images he painted of a finger wag, a stop sign, and a self-portrait are revealed.
I'm turning through the sky, yeah, 200 degrees, that's why they call me Mr. Fahrenheit.
Like his teacher, Eddie Spaghetti, says, it's a modern twist on an old storytelling tradition.
So don't stop me now, I'm having such a good time, I'm having a ball,
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Morgantown, West Virginia.
You will not be sorry if you go check out the video Caitlin made of some of the kids performing with their crankies. It's fabulous and inspiring. Watch it on our website, wvpublic.org. That and the wonderful animated short films that show Mothman monster dancing made by the kids I met in Pocahontas County make me so excited to see what types of stories the next generation of kids makes. Maybe they'll end up here on Inside Appalachia. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Jessica Lilly will be back next week. We had help producing this episode of Inside Appalachia from WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, the Ohio Valley Resource, and Report for America. Music in today's show is provided by Matt Jackford, Dinosaur Burps, and Spencer Elliott. Inside Appalachia is produced by me, Roxy Todd. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Kara Lofton edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You all rock. Thank you. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Roxy Todd. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs, to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.